Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. Nodding along with everything I'm saying and shaking your head at the appropriate points is Juliana.
Hello everyone.
And today we're going to be talking about a book called Slow Gods by Claire North.
Interesting.
But before we get there.
Yeah.
Other books I mentioned at the end of last year that I've been I collected together books that came out in 2025, like a list of books that came out in 2025,
yes,
which were making people's best science fiction of the year end of year lists.
Okay,
I'd read some of them already, you know, like the When There Were Wolves Again and some of these others, but yeah. some other and Shroud that we reviewed I think in the last episode.
Yes, we did.
So some of those were you know on this list, but others I was like, well, let me put them on the list. And since the last review that we recorded, I've tried out two more of those books.
Okay,
and I'm on a third. So I tested out The Incandescent by Emily Tesh, who we know she wrote the space opera with the Valkyrie. Can't remember what the book was. Anyway, Emily Tesh. Second novel comes out. Emily Tesh used to be a associate professor at a boarding school in the UK.
Oh, okay.
And so she's written a magic boarding school adventure story with, you know, like people conjuring demons and doing all that kind of stuff. But from the point of view of the professor or of the of the teachers at the school.
That makes sense.
good, pretty good. 3.98 rating on Goodreads as
an
average.
Is that also your impression of the
book? No, my impression is that it is not a book for me. It is definitely a book for people who are like 10 years younger than me who grew up reading Harry Potter. Like,
okay.
They have a lot, you know, they have a lot of opinions about what magic school should be like and magic school fiction should be like.
Yeah.
I've never read a Harry Potter book in my life and also don't care about magic schools in any way. And then the clever thing that it's a point from the point of view of one of the teachers at the magic school doesn't work on me at all because I don't know. You know, I don't get it. So I stopped reading it. Not because it was bad, but also because I could almost immediately in the first chapter see where it was going. And I realized this is not for me. So I noped out of that.
Okay.
One.
Makes sense. Because this can be for people who were 10 years younger.
Yeah.
When Harry Potter came out.
Yeah.
And also could now be the age of being a professor.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the whole point. Like people in their mid-30s. I'm in my mid-40s. So people in their mid-30s, you know, when those early Harry Potter books were coming out, they were 9 and I was 19.
Yeah.
You know.
So doesn't fit at all.
Was all. I still remember it was sort of like after I'd left college, maybe when I was at university, I can't remember what it was. And I looked at this list of the best selling, but like the Times, you know, the Times of London, whatever it's called, the Times bestseller list.
Any bestseller list were flooded.
Three of the top 10 books were Harry Potter. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. What's this book? And I was like, oh, it's a kid's book.
Mm-hmm.
And another book that I tested out was Anibot by, oh, I didn't look it up. Well, either way, Anibot by the person who wrote Anibot. I realize I don't care enough to look it up because I didn't make a list of it here as well.
You're funny.
3.83 stars out of 5 generally.
Also a book from last year.
Also a book from last year.
Yeah.
Won the Arthur C. Clarke Award or no? It's like it won one of these other awards.
Okay.
And it is probably not good. However, I got partway through the first chapter and there was like a few scenes in.
Yeah.
And I realized this is quite a heavy book. Like it's a book which seems to be about quite a heavy topic.
Mm-hmm.
And the writing gave me zero confidence that the author would be in control of the writing and the metaphor and everything else going on.
And the heavy topic.
And also, I understood that just by the way that the world was set up and that it's about, you know, like a sex domestic robot.
Okay.
Just how the author wrote about the robot made me think, I won't be able to enjoy this because I've read too many books about robots before.
Yeah.
And all of the science fiction-y kind of stuff that's already worked out about robots in science fiction, this author hasn't read and doesn't know. So they're bumping up against things that should have been solved in robots, but now just suddenly aren't.
Mm.
But any robot now that exists confronts things that have been already put in science fiction. Does that make sense?
You mean like robots in real life or in that book?
In our real life now,
yeah,
people talk about robots as though they have as though they know about robots from science fiction.
Yes.
People talk about Terminator. Yes. They talk about Metropolis. Yeah. They talk about, you know, Her, you know, with the artificial intelligence.
Yes.
They talk about the, you know, the iRobot and the three laws of robotics.
Yeah.
They all of this stuff is in the world right now that we already know about with real people in the real world talking about robots.
Yeah.
Have lessons learned or have like thought technologies based on stuff from fiction.
Yes.
And it informs what robots look like. You know, you see the guys who have the CGI robots, the Corridor Crew, who had that viral hit, where it's sort of like, here's the, you know,
the Boston Robotics.
The Boston Dynamics, the Boston Dynamics robot. And that was like, you know, they were kicking and stuff. Like, it's, we already know what that's, you know, what's going on there. Like, we have an understanding of how we want robots to act based on the thought technologies and the thought experiments that science fiction people have done already. And Anibot seemed to be coming in cold, not really having anything to say about robots, but maybe having something to say about sex work or, you know, domestic slaves or whatever. Anyway, it was a bit too heavy, and I realized I'm going to nope out of this one. And then I looked up other people's reviews and I was like, yes, it wasn't just me. Like, I'm so glad that I didn't even get through the first chapter, that I just left after a few scenes.
That's fine, because you know what? You're meant to read books for either enjoyment or some sort of...
It was not enjoyable, because that is a heavy topic.
Yeah, if it's not an enjoyable book, it needs to be a book that activates interest and or something.
So two things. One was that the sex robot was like, oh, my internal temperature is at, you know, 93.2 or it's down to 80. And I was like, oh, robots in the modern world would not calculate their temperatures or track their temperatures in Fahrenheit. They just wouldn't. You just wouldn't do that.
Mm.
If you did want to do it in Fahrenheit, the robot would think in Celsius. And then when they speak to the American, you know, owner, boyfriend, you know, whatever it's going to be,
they would
translate it into Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. And also they were like, oh, and I don't have a sense of smell. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. A sex robot doesn't have a sense of smell. And I'm like, that's going to be...
Oh, and you said she isn't... The sex robot is not only a sex robot,
yeah,
but also
she cooks
domestic
and cleans.
Cooks
and I'm like, how...
Cooking.
Why would you have a robot which couldn't smell a gas leak, which couldn't tell if something was like moldy in the fridge when it's their job to do so? Anyway, none of it made sense at all. And again, I only got a few scenes in and I was like, this is not good.
Okay.
So... Noped out on that one as well.
Two DNFs.
Yes, I'm currently reading Halcyon Years by Alistair Reynolds, and it's good, it's fine. I mean, it's Alistair Reynolds, so there's obviously going to be like a lower level of quality that he'll write to. But today we're going to talk about Slow Gods by Claire North.
Right.
And Claire North, actually, I will now, because I've finished with that list, I will now switch over to my Claire North notes. I've read two previous books by Claire North.
Yeah.
I read The Sudden Disappearance of Hope or Sudden Appearance of Hope. Anyway, I should probably look at what it is. Yep. It's about somebody whose superpower or curse in life is that they always get forgotten.
Mm.
Did you read that one? I don't think you did. But you did read the first 14 lives of Harry August.
15.
First 15 lives of Harry August.
I think.
The first 12 lives of Harry December. it turns out Claire North is actually someone called Catherine Webb. Catherine Webb is a young adult fiction author. And when she writes books which are not young adult books, she puts them under the name Claire North.
So that's something I like the name Claire North.
That's something I learned by looking at the Goodreads author page. So the setup of this book is that there are slow gods, and the slow gods are these like things which roam around the galaxy, and they kind of have a way of they've got this way of calculating what's going to happen in the future.
Okay,
and so they can turn, or maybe they're from the future, or whatever. Either way, so they can work out stuff that's going to happen, and then they'll go around and they'll turn up, but everything happens really slowly. And if they turn up, it's bad because they're there to witness something that's going to happen.
Oh, right.
Probably.
So you don't want them there.
So that's one of the little things. But also, they will give you a warning. So at one point, hey, there is a supernova going to go off here.
Mm-hmm.
And within the first 100 light years, every planet is going to be reduced down to nothing, because just like the neutrino blast or the light blast or the gamma ray blast, whatever it's going to come, it's going to swing through and just sterilize all of the solar systems around it.
Okay, how are they? How are they saying that to?
Well, these gods, they have like these like monoliths. It's sort of like 2001 Space Odyssey style not really. Anyway, it's whatever it is. It's one of these things. Yeah. So. And then, so all of the different like human societies which are around there all have to be like, oh shit, we've got to get our people off these planets before this.
Okay, so humans have spread out.
Humans have spread out around. Okay. They've discovered these slow gods, and also humans have kind of diversified. So on this planet, they're a bit like this biologically, and over here, there's a different society here and a different society there.
Right.
And one of the cool things that's happened, well, not one of the cool things, one of the world-building-y kind of things is that computers, computer ships, culture style computer ships where, you know, the ship has a mind.
Yes.
But it turns out the computer minds can't go faster than light, should do the fast and light travel, because you've got to go through a different place, which is called the arc space.
Right.
And arc space is like the space outside of our space. Mm-hmm. And to go through there, computers can't do it. There has to be a biological mind.
Right.
To take you through.
Yeah.
However, the biological mind latches onto some kind of like evil or some darkness in this other dimension.
Yeah.
And it can drive people crazy. Now, evil in a different dimension where you travel through to get faster than light travel is a well-worn trope in science fiction.
Yeah, that reminded me of some other books we recently read.
Yeah, maybe I know some recent books as well, but just like Event Horizon, you know, you open up a porthole. Oops, we wanted to get to another star, but we ended up going through hell or via hell or whatever it is, and everyone turns crazy on the way out. Warhammer has a big thing about the Warhammer books where they go between planets and star systems, and you can get inflicted by like the dark evil that's inside the, you know, skip space, dark space, hyperspace, whatever it's going to be called here. So that's what happens. So each different civilization or society that's spacefaring has a different way of deciding who has to be a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And in some, people volunteer to be a pilot because you're probably going to be okay for one trip. It might drive you crazy, but it probably won't drive you crazy. You've only got to do it once, there and back, and then you can retire on the riches of whatever it is.
Right.
Like that.
Yeah.
This
is the kind of thing that in lots of other science fiction books you have the navigators.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They are specialized, or they are biologically advanced in that respect.
These are totally Dune Arrakis. Right. We've got to get around the spice navigators. You know, that's the kind of thing. There is one. So there's like this big culture, not culture, I shouldn't say culture. It's called the Accord. And that is like the culture, you know, that's like the post-scarcity. Mm-hmm. We're going to look after everyone. And they have a way of using, you know, volunteers and stuff.
Right.
And the ships are really good. But again, the ships can't move around without a biological brain, human brain to guide them as well.
Yeah.
And there's a few others as well. And then there's one which is called the Shine. And the Shine is the hyper-capitalistic society. Mentioned this before with Shroud, that there's the, you know, they're doing this expansion throughout and everyone has to work to be not put in, you know, in cold sleep and things, and people are earning their wages.
Yep.
And with in here, the Shine is like that. So you get the middle managers and the upper managers and they do really well. And then, of course, when one of their planets is going to be swept over, they're like, right, we've got to work to get everyone off the planet. And then they're like,
maybe not everyone.
Actually, it's not worth it from a, you know, capitalist point of view to get everyone off, because most people are just working class and really we just need middle management and upper management to get together and we'll get them off the ship. And then they go and then they try and take over, at some point they try and take over another planet, and they're like, we're turning up here and there's a war and the people there are sort of, they're being brought into the Shine. I actually really like the idea of the Shine, because the people there, you also have shine if you're like a CEO. And this is kind of reflecting what people are like in our modern world.
Yeah.
You know, oh, he's got a lot of shine. Why? Oh, well, he shouts at people and is mean, but he's got like this brilliance to him. And of course, he's worth it, you know, keeping these people here as well. It's pretty good satire. So anyway, that's all good stuff. And so our main character throughout this is called Moore. His real name is Marukana Novdenzaze. And he's our main character, and we meet him. He's a gardener, and he's also a long-term pilot.
Gardener. I like that.
And he's a long-term pilot because on his first... And he's from The Shine. He was, you know...
Oh, right.
He was a volunteer. He got injured in an accident, and they're like, great, you're now volunteered for, what is it, excursions? And he's like, yeah, what does that mean? He's like, yeah, okay. And his brain, when his ship went through arc space, his mind, not just his mind, but his whole body was like infested by whatever is in arc space, this dark
evil
darkness. And he comes out the other side.
Yeah.
And this is all kind of explained right at the start of the book here. Mm-hmm. Comes out the other side, kills everybody else on his ship.
Oh, no.
But then flies his ship and keep flying the ship. And is also... becomes immortal because he only exists partially in our world, and the rest of him always exists in arc space.
Right.
And so if he dies...
He becomes a split personality.
Well, if he dies, he's still alive in the other arc space, and then his body is all patched up and he comes back to life again.
Ooh, that's an interesting... And if he dies, like a Frankenstein double.
So yes, it is. But the way that it works is that if you kill him, you have to keep believing... someone has to keep consciously believing that he's dead, otherwise he comes back to life again.
Oh,
and also,
cool.
If you take your eyes off him and it's dark, so there's not actually any light, he can just, you know, walk through walls. Anyway, so this is our main guy. Moore is our main character.
Interesting character.
And Moore is superpower being travel around in a ship anywhere, you know, without worrying about going mad. Or
because
is he
you're already
mad?
Whatever.
He always mad. So that's the whole situation. Planet, star exploding, Moore, pretty much immortal, can't be killed, but can fly a ship around.
But is not a god.
But is not, let's say, not yet a god.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the setup.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sounds all good.
Fun.
Pretty good science fiction, space opera kind of stuff.
Yes.
So this... I've mentioned the culture a few times.
Yes.
Mentioned starships a few times with, you know,
yep, with
personalities
minds
and stuff. Mm-hmm. And also the Accord is a bit like the culture. And also the slow gods themselves, which are these big things which are like above humanity.
Mm.
You get those things in the culture novels as well. You get these things like these... what are they
like
called?
Entities?
Yeah, these entities. Like some things will go in up to transcend into a higher level, but still can be around and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of that going on. It feels like Claire North, Catherine Webb, Claire North has been like, hey, it's been a while since I've read a culture novel. Because Ian and Banks died.
No more culture novels coming.
Yeah, there's no more culture novels coming.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, how close can I write a culture novel? And it's not just me who said this. I follow someone on Blue Sky who was like, wow, this is like the culture. And I was like, I know. So I previously have thought this. I came up with a whole outline of a novel. And I was like, if I ever wanted to write a novel that was like fan fiction of the culture, I've got a list of ingredients of the things which would have to be in the novel.
Yeah.
In the end, I never did write it because I kind of moved on from writing my own novels. And of course, if you're going to write an entire novel, why would it be fan fiction? Why wouldn't it just be your own creation, like work on your own IP, your own intellectual property?
Yep.
I wrote an entire musical, which was based on Groundhog Day. And then somebody else wrote an entire musical based on Groundhog Day. And that then became and mine is just sitting there like useless. If you know. So learn your lesson, work on your own intellectual property, your own IP.
Yeah.
Don't put the effort into writing it. However, the list of things that I would write down to say, all of these things have to be in a culture novel if I want it to be...
The culture novel recipe.
There's a recipe for a culture novel book.
Yeah.
Which will be something like ... this. And I had this list of things, and I also had like a storyline which like would, and it's impressive that Claire North would ever think that she could get away with doing this without people like me thinking, well, you're just putting in all the elements that would normally be in a culture novel.
Yeah.
So,
but you must know that by now there is another generation of people who read books who wouldn't maybe immediately pick that up, because the culture novel it's not.
Yeah, but you know, I'm not saying that you need to pick it up. I'm not saying that you don't need to pick it up. I'm just saying that literally the list of things that I have in my head, or did have in my head, or even wrote down as a story outline of the kind of things that should have to happen for it to be fan fiction of a culture novel or a pastiche of a culture novel, or to, you know, reference culture novels and that kind of stuff. Like, I'm not kidding. 80% of them are in this book.
I bet.
The names have been changed. It's not the culture. It's like different things. It's the Accord. It's not the culture. There's not ship minds. There's ship personality, or whatever it's going to be. Yeah. You know, there's all these different kind of stuff.
Okay.
It's like a culture novel with the labels scribbled out and other stuff written over the top.
Okay.
So, for example, there is so the Accord is like the culture, and they're like, we need a thing, or maybe it wasn't the Accord, I can't remember, but you get these things, and you're like, we need an agent to go down there.
Yeah.
And of course, it would make 100% sense in all of these situations for the ships to just look at the situation and go, right, we can just transport, or, you know, we can just grab something from the surface of the planet, mm-hmm. and like teleport it here. You know, the ships could do all that kind of stuff, but they don't. They want to go through, like, they want to have the humans doing the jobs, doing the dirty work. They send in the human agents to keep it all at that level, kind of because it's like more fair to do it that way.
Yeah.
But in this case, there's a good plot point. There's a good plot reason why one person should be sent there,
mm-hmm.
because Moore is going to a planet which is going to be destroyed by this gamma ray burst neutrino thing that's going to come through. But he has a personal relationship with somebody down there who is the person that needs to connect up with.
Yeah.
And this is a classic culture novel Ian M. Banks thing. Like, oh, right, okay, we need someone to do it. We need to find someone who's got a personal connection with that person.
Yeah.
And that's the person we're going to send to meet the person to do the thing. Like, almost all of the books are like that as well. They are taken from their own world, which they're very comfortable with. So the only reason they're doing this is because they've been asked to nicely. They can't be forced to do it. But they are, at the moment, playing a musical instrument, or getting into board games, or learning about a thing, or
being gardeners.
Yeah,
and
being a gardener. Oh, right, okay. So it comes away like this. And of course, so now there is a situation where you have to do something, and it's a race against time.
Yeah.
Now, the whole kind of thing, just go right all the way back to the very first culture novel, which is Consider Phlebas.
Yes.
And they're like, right, you've got to go onto a ship, but the ship is going to crash. So you've got to get the thing off the ship before the ship crashes, you know, like a ship at sea.
Yeah.
And the ship's going to crash. So go down there, and they have an adventure racing against time to find the thing on the ship before the ship crashes. And then they get off that ship and they go somewhere else. But the whole thing is on an orbital, which for weird war reasons is going to be destroyed by one side or the other side in a war, because it can't be a neutral territory.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, if it can't be a neutral territory, it's got to be destroyed. And then they're like, well, now this next adventure scene has to happen on the thing which is out of your control, about to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got this orbital that's going to be about destroyed. But of course, we're going to have an adventure there. There's going to be like a gambling thing, but you're there in a spaceship, so you can take off. Before it happened, hopefully everyone else will be able to take off before the whole thing gets destroyed. And that's exactly what's happening here. Get someone who's got a personal connection with somebody down on the planet, send them down to get the MacGuffin from the planet.
Yeah.
Before it gets destroyed, and it being destroyed and all that kind of stuff is outside of the control of it. But then you have to have a shooty adventure-y kind of story going down there on the planet.
Yeah.
So I was like, and then a bit later, I was like, at this point in the novel, if this was a culture novel, there would be an aside about people who are like in this post-scarcity society, or whatever society is, they will have to do a dangerous thing, you know, which might endanger them, but they probably live through, but, you know, they've got to inject fake adventure into their lives. So Ian M. Banks talks about people, you know, jumping into stars, or there's this thing where you go whitewater rafting down a volcano, you know, you go out hunting.
Yeah, because the unwritten rule of post-scarcity is that people get bored of the perfect life around.
A game where you're actually betting people's lives to do it.
Yeah.
And then the thing that you need to do is, if you run out of other people's lives to kill in the gambling game, you can bid your own life if you think you've got a real,
or parts of your life.
I'm just saying, consider.
Yes.
But also, same kind of thing in a player of games. You're on a planet and there's a firestorm that swoops around the planet each time. And the final thing, you you're in the path of a firestorm, and mm-hmm. that's the thing that, you know, that yeah. you've got, that you might survive it, but everyone around you might die, but you've got to do this job before you get, you know, exactly that. And just as I was getting to this point where, like, oh, we need something, Claire North goes on a diversion. Oh, and in this place, what they do is the young men grab the feet of the dragon bird thing, and then they fly down and they do this flying thing across there. And if they were lucky, if they do well, they get down to the bottom and they pass through from childhood into manhood and then become men. And that's, and I was like, oh, we are just like exactly at the point of the book where I was expecting to have bored rich citizens do an extreme dangerous sport. Literally in the book, minutes later in the audiobook, we had that as well. So, and again, that's not just it. There are many other things that I would have in my head of the things that you would need if I was to write culture novel fan fiction, the things that would need to be there, that I would need to tick off the list to be there. Those are the things that would have to be there. So,
okay.
That's it. Another thing that I wanted to say about this is, yeah, Agent sent in Boardrich, The Shine. I like The Shine. It's a very good world building with The Shine. Arc Space. Oh, right. So down here at the down here, there's this thing where our main character is a gardener. And my thing, my point of view about this book is that the gods in this book, the slow gods themselves, mm-hmm. they are in fact themselves gardeners, and the solar system is their garden. So in the yep. same way that humans go around and they look at a plant and go, yeah, I'll snip a bit off here, I'll trim yep. a bit there, I'll prod it, go, and that's what I was thinking.
I divide this up.
Yeah, I'll
so
divide this thing, this,
yeah.
move this thing, sweep around that, plant something there, hope mm-hmm. something grows there. And this is what I was thinking through the book. I was like, yeah, our main character's a gardener. And of course, he's like immortal, and he's probably going to become, like, by the end of it, mild spoilers at the end of the book, the gods actually talk to him and say, yeah, you're the only thing apart from us who's which is probably immortal, but we don't quite understand you because mm-hmm. you're an out of context situation, or whatever they say in the culture novel.
Yeah.
Like, this is a factor. And then I was like, yeah, but he's a gardener and you're a gardener. And then they're like, and I don't think it ever gets that explicit by the end yeah. of the book, but they're pretty much saying, oh, what we do is, well, sometimes we plant something and sometimes we prune something and sometimes we trim something and sometimes we'll do an experiment. We'll cross-pollinate this with this and sometimes we'll do that. And I'm like gardeners. Mm-hmm. And the book, I don't think it ever actually says, our main character's a gardener and also the slow gods are also gardeners. But it felt like that's the kind of thing. But there's actually some really good fun stuff in the end of the book where it talks about, like, you know, in ethics of being immortal and that mm-hmm. kind of stuff, which is really good. So also I forgot to mention this, the audiobook is narrated by Peter Kenny, who narrates all of the culture novels. So as I'm all this stuff is being read to me, I'm like, you even got Peter fucking Kenny to read the audiobook of the novel, which is so not a culture novel, but so wanting to be a culture novel yeah. all the way through. So one of the world-building thing is that, like, every planet gets their own pronouns, and I had zero interest in that. And I've heard, I can't remember who said it, but on another podcast I listened to, it could have been a Meal of Thorns podcast or a Wizards versus Lesbians podcast, they say, our rule is that we don't apologize for misgendering a fictional character with fictional made-up pronouns.
Yeah.
And this book seems to be intentionally trying out as many pronouns as possible.
But I like that, because this is literally...
Let me finish.
Okay. What I'm trying to say here
yeah.
is... that books,
yeah.
fiction, is yeah. by default
yeah.
a playground for all that.
Yeah,
but no, listen, it makes so much sense to have authors putting out literal ideas, and if it's too many, okay.
Okay. The thing is, there is...
Of course, you can't keep track of it.
You can't keep track because there's like one planet has like 8 genders.
Yeah.
And other planets have 5 genders, and some yeah. have 4 genders, and some have 6 genders. And there's like 6 planets mentioned. Mm-hmm. And so you're up to like 24 genders,
yeah.
which every single one of them is meaningless to me, because me as a human being, I can track down like a few gender options.
Exactly.
And then
so
what
be happy that you're human yeah. and you don't yeah, have to deal with all
but
that.
Here's the thing. In the book itself doesn't do a good enough job of making me believe that these agendas, and rather just, oh, this is Mr. something, this is Professor something, mm-hmm. and this is President something. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the book seems to be confusing what a gender is and what a title is.
Okay.
So if I call you Mr., that's something different from Mrs., which is something different from Miss, which is something different from Sir, which is something different from Professor, which is something different from Herr Doctor Doctor. And all these other kind of things.
Yeah.
Like, it's sort of like, oh, and that person's definitely a he or a him. And I was like, oh, man, you're even putting all these accents and right there. And it, in all of it, except for one case where I managed to keep track of one difference in gender.
Yeah.
It was indistinguishable from a job title or positional title or okay. whatever, you know,
yeah.
or a like a societal label. Like, it's like confusing like class systems with gender mm-hmm. or a caste system with gender.
Okay.
And that it just didn't feel like what that's what genders are.
Yeah.
You know, these people don't have pronouns, they have titles.
Okay.
And if they don't have a pronoun, it, they, them. So pretty much all I was doing is if I didn't know if it was a he or a she, I just translated the into a they.
Okay.
And that's it. You know, because there's nothing else for me to do, because there was nothing else for me to latch onto, mm. or it was too difficult for me to keep track of.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I wish that hadn't been there, because it felt like more of a joke by the author rather than an exploration of what gender means.
Mm. Okay.
Which is pretty much satire on what science fiction is at the moment, to be honest. So, like, I understand the impulse to go, oh, you think you've got a lot of genders in your book and interesting? Yeah. Well, check it out. I can go for 28
okay.
unique genders.
Now I get it. Okay.
So, after all of this thing, you would think that I would be really interested in a book which was like a culture novel and that I'd really enjoy it.
Yeah.
And there are parts of this book that I quite enjoyed.
Okay. That was a very British way of saying...
It got to 60% of the way through.
Yeah.
We've had our big adventure mm-hmm. We've had our big Ian M. Bank style adventure on an Ian M. Bank style disaster happening in the background, and there's stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't a firestorm sweeping around a planet, and it isn't an orbital being destroyed, and it isn't a war that's going to sweep through any moment, and it
yeah.
isn't a ship that's going to crash and mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. It's, you know,
something
else. Mm. But all of that happens, and it's kind of exciting
mm-hmm.
and interesting
mm-hmm.
and kind of sad, because someone might die and somebody might be saved, and there's going to have to be sacrifice and all the kind of good stuff that you're expecting from this.
Yeah.
And then the book collapses into a void of no story.
What?
Nothing. Yeah, they just sort of like, oh, and then that was it. And I was like, oh, I still got like almost half of the book left to go. And the main climax happens like about halfway through the book.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly I was like, there's like this time skip, and I'm like, oh, so we moved on from that. Okay, so that's all settled. And then nothing happens for ages. And it slows down. And I was like, this isn't slow gods. This is slow book. This is slow plotting. And I really struggled with like the next like quarter of the book. Like, this is a, what does it say here? How long is this book? 12-hour book. You get to six hours into the book, and I'm like, this is great. This is all good. This
yeah.
is what I want.
Yeah.
It's like, is Claire North going to do more, you know, Ian M. Banks culture novel pastiches in the future, and I'm going to be up for it, you know, or whatever. And then it just got just rough. And I was struggling, and I was like, and then in the end, I had to kind of force my way through this like next quarter of the book.
Okay,
like, this next section
of the
book.
That's a pity.
And then at the end, it did pick up a little bit. It got a little bit more interesting.
Yeah.
But I was like,
why did you have to put this?
And I looked up some other people's reviews, and some other people's reviews were like, well, I guess you could call it maybe experimental story structure, or you could say bad plotting event. So yes,
okay.
It felt like it was all intentional, but oh my goodness, that was rough. That middle section of the book was rough. So this could have been like, hey, pretty good, 4-star book.
Yeah, and sounded like that was where we were heading towards.
Yes, it feels like that. It feels like that. Again, I could see through the matrix a bit too much and realize it was just the stuff that when I was going to write, when I was thinking about writing my own Ian M. Banks culture fan fiction,
this would all be in it.
It would have been in there. I wouldn't say I'd do a better job, but like I had the same list and it was fun ticking those things off the list.
Yeah.
And then it was fun seeing other people reading it at the same time, you know, other people like catching up with books from last year and posting on Blue Sky and their blogs and stuff going, wow, this is really like the culture. And I'm like, ah, yep, yeah, that's good. So let's have a quick look. I brought this one.
So we're now on Goodreads.
Yeah, Goodreads. This is someone who gave it 2 stars. I'm going to give it slightly more than 2 stars. I'd probably give it 3 stars, but like a low 3 stars, like a 2.5 stars, because this is almost, I'll give it 2 stars. And this is Denise said, I went into Slow Gods with reasonably high expectations. I've read Claire North before and usually enjoy the precision and intellect she brings to the world. Yes, Claire North is obviously very clever. Like, the things that she does in her books, I'm like, this is very clever. But this didn't feel clever enough because it felt like you're not doing anything that Ian M. Banks hasn't done before, but you just got your own little spin on it. It says, this time, though, I bounced hard. It's an adult space sci-fi novel centered on our protagonist, Moore. And while the premise had promise, the execution left me feeling like I'd been locked in a beige room with a damp cloth for company. The narrative structure is peculiar. Let's be generous and call it experimental. Less generously, let's call it dry and oddly monotone. So, Moore, bless him, has the personality of stale bread. Not freshly stale either. The kind that's been left out for days and could probably be used as a weapon. Not moldy either. That would give it flavor. Just dry.
Oh, that's very good.
So, 2 stars. One for those is the one. One of those is for the pretty book. The other is me being polite. The rest is silence. So, yeah. He says, there are a few tiny moments where I saw the social commentary and wit I'm used to from her, but otherwise I came away with nothing. Now, here's the thing. I think the social commentary and satire is good.
Yeah.
Because if you're a British science fiction author who's doing like, you know, like bumping up against Ian M. Banks and, you know, that kind of, it's there's always a lot of social
include
commentary.
Social criticism in the form of sarcasm.
Yeah, well, not sarcasm, like satire, also sarcasm, but and cynicism and that kind of stuff is like really rooted there in the science fiction space opera tradition. And
yes.
Claire North is doing that. There are bits of the book which are very witty and fun satire on this kind of stuff, but it is. Like our main character, for someone who is so could be so fantastic, doesn't have a whole lot going on in their head.
Okay.
Which is a pity for someone who in the future might be an immortal being who is on the same level as a god.
Written by obviously a person that has all that in her head.
Yeah, it's like the main character isn't as clever as I know Claire North must be from the other books that I've read from her.
Yeah.
And again, one of those is a like live a life over time loop novel, which again is very similar, not similar, but like similar things that I'm interested in science fiction and that I have read before, I've written before and read a lot before. Feels like she's got the same grounding in that science fiction, like British science fiction heritage there.
Yeah.
And
is
playing in spaces which should be really interesting to me. But this execution was felt really good until about 60% of the way through, fell apart and just never got me back on side again.
Yeah, so, obviously you're not the only person.
I'm not the only person. However, really good overall rating and that 4.0, like above 4 stars.
All right.
But here's the thing. I reckon a lot of people didn't rate this book because they didn't finish it. So check out this here as well. Friends and following. Someone here rated it 5 stars. Mikkel rated it 4 stars. Ellison rated it 1 star. Whatever this was, it wasn't space opera or operatic on any 11 or even science fiction. It was slow, though. Tamahomi rated it 1 star. What was that? Read 10% of it. I think it's a comedy, but you have to be British. Let every planet have their own pronouns. Would probably win a Hugo if the author was American. So again, doing the right thing.
Very good.
So yes, one of my friends rated it. And then lots of other people rated 4 stars and 3 stars.
How many people in total have rated it?
It has 2,614
That
reviews.
Also isn't a lot.
But again, a lot of people not giving it like DNF don't read it and they don't give it a rating. So that rating isn't
Isn't reflected.
Isn't reflected.
Yeah.
Like my reviews that I just gave of The Incandescent and the other one.
And Anibot.
And Anibot. I didn't rate them because I was like, oh, I only read
and
the
first
chapter.
I think that is a big problem in this rating system because DNFs are not reflected. If you could say, okay, zero stars.
Yeah, it would be good to see, like this kind of thing here. It said, what does it say here? So it's got 1,050 5-star reviews, then 878. So like pretty good. But you get down to 46 people rated it 1-star, and it would be really good to see, oh, and 200 people
didn't finish it and didn't rate it.
And I'd be like, oh.
And so this is totally...
So that's a big... That would be a big chunk. That would be a good 10% of people who read the book didn't finish it and didn't rate it.
Yes.
That would be a good signal.
And so this is actually then a really big... now I'm missing the word. It changes the statistics.
Yeah. DNFs aren't factored in.
Yeah. And I think, especially in a book like this... obviously, there was, like you said, 60% of the book or half the book was there. And then obviously, or even at the beginning, people gave up. And
here's the thing.
I think it should be factored in.
50% of the way through this book, I would never say, I mean, there's absolutely no way at all I'd be like, I'm not finishing this book.
Yeah.
When I was 50% of the way through the book, I'd be like, well, of course, this is going to be one of my favorite books of the year. Yeah. And of course, I'm going to finish it. Because it didn't even occur to me that I might not finish the book.
And
then when I was 65% of the way through the book, I was like, I might not get to the end of this.
Yeah.
And that's not a feeling that I want during the course of reading the book, even if the author's doing something experimental. And by the end, it pays off. And I'm like, I see what you did now. And the whole middle boring bit was because of this, and this was being revealed. But I review a book based on my personal enjoyment of the experience of reading it.
Yeah.
And how I feel at 1% of the way through the book, to me, is just as important as how I feel at 99% of the way through the book.
Yeah.
And where I feel at 40% of the book is just as meaningful to me enjoyment-wise as 60% of the way through
Absolutely.
The book. I mean, probably not. Probably by the time I get to the end of a book, how I enjoy it at the end does outweigh how much I'm enjoying it halfway through.
Yeah.
But still, that's how I like to review it.
Yeah.
Like, I like to review my reading experience and what it makes me think about, like, before I think about it too hard and start talking about it, because otherwise I'm giving a book a rating if you and me had a good chat about it afterwards.
That can totally influence it.
Yeah, you can influence it. Be like, oh, like that. So, yes.
What's the verdict then?
I think 2.5 stars.
Okay.
Because it is really good at some points, but then it's really... Well, let's say I feel like if I give it 3 stars, I'm recommending it to people.
Right.
And I think I can only recommend it to people if you think you can get stuff out of this book. And I think a lot of people do get a lot out of it. And I think I got a lot out of it as well.
Yeah. So I think I actually...
But there's this enjoyable rating as well.
I'd actually go along with Tamahomi's review here then. If you are in your... Between your like 30s and 40s, mid-40s or something.
Yeah.
And you're British.
Yeah.
This might be actually a bit more for you.
Yes, but here's the thing. It's kind of not enough for me.
Yeah.
Because... I have read all the culture novels, and they are some of my favorite. We still got one outstanding one that we haven't reviewed yet, or whatever, like which we'll get to at some point.
Okay,
maybe. But what am I trying to say?
It's actually disappointing that you have all this knowledge.
I think I would have some parts of it. I think I would have found more clever if it wasn't to me transparently a culture novel riff.
Mm-hmm.
But again, so many people think the culture novel is like, oh, we need spaceships with personalities and we need a powerful, post-scarcity utopian society. And I'm like, yes, all of that. But then the culture novels have like these human agents which are being controlled by godlike beings to go to a place which is dangerous to meet the person that they have a connection to before and to do, you know.
There's more to the recipe.
And there's a dangerous thing going on and there's some dangerous activity that people choose to do to make their life spice up. Because otherwise, all that kind of stuff.
You know, there's a recipe for shepherd's pie.
Yeah.
But you need the Worcester sauce in it.
Worcestershire sauce. Either way, yes. I felt like I would want... But I think Claire North does put in original stuff. Like, again, The Shine is very good.
Yeah.
The actual gardener kind of thing and the slow god stuff. It is very... There's a lot of very good stuff in here. Mm-hmm. But the actual action and characters, like, Ian and Banks just wrote way better characters as his main characters than Moore. Again, I've just read the book. I can't remember very much about them. And if you just tell me, hey, name not even the character, but like what are the defining characteristics about the main character in this, you know, culture novel, which I've not read for 15 years, I reckon that I could probably pick, you know, I could pick it out. I could say, oh yeah, that's the book where this person is the main character and they do this and this and this and this is their journey.
Yeah.
You know, of this is their character arc or whatever it's going to be. So there you go.
Okay.
This is meant to be a quick podcast, so let's wrap it up.
You promised 20 minutes.
I think we talked well about this book for 20 minutes. And then for the last 10 minutes, we've just been circling around the same points again and again.
What's the number?
It says 44 minutes.
All right.
Oh, just about to take a... It says 45 minutes. So let's wrap it up there.
What's up next?
Next up, well, I'm currently reading Halcyon Days, which is another one of these things that were on people's best books of last year.
Okay.
Thing. So that's by Alistair Reynolds. So I've got like a few hours of that left.
Nice.
I'm reading War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, and that's like a SFBRP must reads list reread.
Yes.
Which I'm very, very much enjoying. That's good. I got that as a library book. What book are you reading?
I had a bit of a gap because I put two books on hold in the library. Yep. They obviously very much in demand. I put one that's called Mainframes and Monsters or something.
Mainframes and Monsters.
And the other one is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which I haven't read yet because I've only ever watched a movie.
The whole point of this is another SFBRP must reads list reread or first read for you, Leon.
And there's a surprise coming, and I'm going to talk about that the next episode, probably.
Surprise coming? Mm. Do I know about this?
No.
Okay, well, let's get to that at some point then. All right, yes, become my friend on Goodreads so I can see what books you read last year and which are your favourite books of last year.
Yeah.
And and also, if there's other books that came out last year that you want me to read, go over to the goodreads.com SFBRP listener group and post some stuff on there.
Yeah.
Some other people... You know, check it out. Again, there's not much discussion there, like one or two posts every month, but it's a great way to get in contact with me and give me a list of books to read.
Yes, or just podcasts.
Episode feedback, books I'd like to see reviewed, SFBRP must read list. There's various discussions that you can check out there. So, the other books on the list of books that I might get to in the future quickly is Notes from a Regicide by Isaac Fellman, A Granite Silence by Nina Allen, Rakes Fall by Vajra Chandrasekara, Luminous by Sylvia Park, and The Expansion Project by Ben Pester.
All right.
So those are some other books.
I have not heard any of these titles before.
I'm just saying, if anyone's got any opinions on those, which ones they'd like me to, that I should or maybe shouldn't bother reading, get back to me on the SFBRP
listener group
on Goodreads is probably the best way to do it.
Cool.
You can follow me on Mastodon and Blue Sky, etc. Otherwise, I think that's it. Should we say goodbye?
We say goodbye.
Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.